Good afternoon. Welcome to Writers' Week and to a session with the lovely Lisa Miller, who you may, if you're up early enough, watch on ABC TV, but otherwise you might have seen Muster Dogs. And if you haven't, I can assure you after this, you probably will. My name's Amanda Vanstone. I think Louise Adler chose me for this because she knows I love dogs. Lisa's maligned her recently and says she hates dogs. Louise has been very quick to point out that's not right. She's terrified of them. Now, I don't know why. If she saw my lovely urn, I mean, running at you at 35 kilos, yes, you might think twice, but he's just a sook, really. So, can we start off? So, this is not about Fear of Flying or Learning to Fly, the first book that Lisa did, which is a great read. If you haven't read it, I don't know if we've got it today, but I recommend you get it. Okay, we do.
I'll sign that as well over
there. We do. It's a great read, and this is also a great read. I don't normally endorse products because you never know the other person's going to like it as much, you know. They go away thinking, oh, bloody idiot told me to buy that book and it's, you know, terrible. So I'm a bit cautious about that sort of thing. But I have to say, if you're looking for a good book, a pleasant, happy read, you want to rush over and get one. And if you've got birthdays or, well, Christmas is a way off. But if you're one of those people that, Mother's Day, okay, she's desperate, I'm not. You know, if you're one of those people that insists on taking a gift to a dinner party, I hate it when people do that to me because I feel I have to reciprocate. Bring a bottle of wine, yes, but after that, leave it. But in this case, the book would be a perfect, perfect gift. It is a happy, joyous, pleasant read. And not just because I love dogs, because it's large, it is partly about dogs, but a lot of it is not. So, let me start with the most difficult question for Lisa. I found myself laughing hysterically at page... can't read my number, but anyway, it was a small number. I think it's page 15, there it is. And then again in page 36, 735. Because what she says in these pages is that most people in the rural industry are scared of going on the media in case they make them look bad. I'm laughing hysterically thinking, who does she think that doesn't apply to? Everyone's afraid of the media making them look bad. And then I think it's your editor, a film editor, John Unwin, made the point to her. Do you know people are afraid we'll make them look bad? I thought, what part of that doesn't she get? She gets just about everything, but she doesn't get that people are apprehensive about the media.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Well, I wrote it. Now, hello, Amanda.
Hi, how are you?
It's great to see you. Amanda and I actually go way back, and I think there might be a bit of competition here today about who's interviewing who, but Amanda reckons that she's the boss, so I have to sort of bow to that authority today. Well, the thing with Muster Dogs, from the very beginning of it, was that these people weren't looking for Instagram clicks. They weren't signing up to a reality TV show that they thought was going to turn them into stars or get them a TV series. They were vulnerable people, and that was really on our minds when we were going into the show.
Yeah. Look, there was one other thing that grabbed me in a very minor, pathetic way, which is not really of interest to you, but I've got it for the minute, so I'm going to use it. You know, I spent a few years in Italy. I'll just remind you, you don't get those jobs because the Prime Minister likes you. You get them because he wants to get rid of you. Anyway, I'm told there's a property named Garibaldi near Wilcannia in New South Wales. And Garibaldi is the indigenous name for a local hill. And I thought, she's having me on. Garibaldi, Italy? Garibaldi Indigenous, what's going on there?
Yeah.
That can't be right.
Yeah, no, it is, because that's CJ's property. So that's actually in the Northern Territory. So CJ the participant from Series 1 who had the dog Spice with her husband Joe, and they had a big property, and CJ now has gone on to do an amazing things. Like, I love what all of them have gone on to do, and in fact, I think I can share with you, although it could be a secret, so don't tell anyone, that we're we're going to do a TV series about where they all are now and what's happened to them since you first met them a couple of years ago.
Which is a
great opportunity for me to hit the road again because I'll be able to get around and go and meet them. And we're going to go and see the winner of Series 2 and the winner of Series 1, Frank Finger and Zoe, when they go out together for the first time at Rockhampton Beef Week, which is going to be really fun.
Okay, now, could we have a hands up who has a dog or has had a dog that's important to them in their life?
Yeah.
Great.
And we've got a good audience here.
What about cats? Okay.
Oh, okay. There's a few cats. I'm allergic to cats. There's never going to be a muster cat. Sorry. It's just never going to happen. Not with me, anyway.
Well, dogs do have a special place in our lives. Look, I've mentioned to you already, I think it's a great book and that it's a joy to read. But one of the things I found great about it was it did, through the book, demonstrate the richness of lives that people live in the country. And maybe I bump into the wrong people, but I do know a number of city people who, when you say, well, so-and-so's coming down from the country, you get a raised eyebrow as if to say, well, they won't understand us. You know, we're important city people, important, especially if they live in the wealthier suburbs. But even people in not wealthier suburbs have a view that some do anyway, that people from the country are somehow hick or out of touch. And when you read this, you feel like grabbing these people and saying, have you read this? Do you realise what you're missing out on? You've lived in the country, so
well,
tell us about
that. Well, I did. I grew up in a town called Kilkeithen, which has a population of about 600 people, and mum and dad were dairy farmers, although by the time I came along, they'd sold the dairy cows. My older siblings always said I got the easy part of the bargain because they were the ones who had to get up before dawn to go down and help mum and dad milk the cows. But we lived in the country still then for a long time, and I still have great friends back there. And even when we moved, it was to the big metropolis of Gympie, which had a population of about 10,000 at the time. And, you know, the great ambition was whether you could become the Gympie Gold Rush Queen. And that was what we thought, you know, during high school, that, wow, you'd really made it if you were either the showgirl, Gympie showgirl, or Gympie Gold Rush Queen, neither of which I attained and therefore still have ambition that I have not made yet, Amanda. But yes, this is what I wanted to do with the book as well, just while I've got the microphone, is that I wanted to tell the people stories behind the tales that you saw on television, because you got a glimpse of, for example, when Carolyn Hudson, who with Mick bred the Border Collies for the second series, Carolyn cried on air when she had to say goodbye to those pups. And it was a really touching moment, and Carolyn was embarrassed. And she didn't want that to go to air because it was like, oh, no, you know, I should be hard and tough. And I rang her one day and I interviewed all these people and spent a lot of time talking to them, either going to their homes or talking on the phone. And Carolyn explained a bit about her life, about how she and Mick had got through the millennium drought and were still in debt from that time. And at the time, she was an older mum who gave birth prematurely to twins that were rushed to Sydney by helicopter and barely survived. And Mick was trying to keep the property going and animals alive while worrying about the health of his wife and his children. And it was all just a mess. And I said to her, God, Carolyn, if you want to cry when you're saying goodbye to those pups, you cry. Like, who are we to judge when you have had this incredible life? And so those stories and the birth of her babies and the fact she was working two part-time jobs until the day she went into premature labour to try and bring money in because of the drought, they're the stories I think we all need to hear.
Hmm. But there's more stories than that, and I'm inviting you to tell us more. Because the hardship stories, we do sometimes get through the media, and that's a great one. Someone working two jobs up until premature delivery. Jesus. Well, sorry. Heavens above. Heaven's above. That's where Jesus apparently is, if you're a believer.
I think we broke the swearing rule early on.
The daily life. Did I swear earlier?
Well, I think I might have. Oh. But anyway, they're going to destroy the tape and no one's telling anything outside.
What about
outside?
the normal life?
Yes.
That is so rich.
Yes.
Because they get community.
Yeah.
You got an example of that?
Well, I think about Lily in Wilcannia. She was in Wilcannia. And I think about her and her mum and her mum, Mog, and they run this cattle...
Well, don't say too much about her because she's one I'm going to ask you about later.
Oh, okay.
Well, say a bit about her.
Okay, I will. Just a little bit. That she grew up basically with a chook under each arm and she'd know their pedigree and she'd go off to the Wilcannia show to show these chooks and always had this great affinity with the animals. But it's these communities around them that are just so strong. Steve in Winton... in the wheelchair who... Oh, can
Again,
I tell you...
Careful.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to tell you...
I like the same people.
Oh, okay. Well, you can ask me a question then and I'll you right. tell me. Go
All
on.
All right. Well, look, can we just explain? Because you know, I've seen a little bit about...
Why, I always feel like I'm in trouble when you start your question.
No. The time from the first bright spark idea to perhaps the first episode filming...
Yeah.
Was that about 3 years?
Oh, probably even longer. Like TV takes a long time, but you've got to convince the bosses to get the money. And the producers, it was an outside production company, and they tell this great story about how the idea came about because one of the producers, he'd gone to his sister's 70th birthday party on a farm in Victoria and there were these gorgeous puppies there and people started talking about it and he was like, wow, like how do these puppies at just weeks of age already have this instinct to be working dogs? Like how does that happen? And then they started thinking maybe there was a show in that and then someone else came up with an idea about trying to make it something of a competition. But they went into the ABC to try and pitch it at the ABC. And there's a bit of an urban myth that, well, it could be an urban myth, it could be true, quite frankly, that wherever your meeting takes place in the building, that's kind of the importance of how they regard you. And the Muster Dogs people, they met in the lobby, in the foyer. So they walked away from that meeting thinking, we've got no chance. But then what happened was COVID and all the borders closed and TV production shut down everywhere and American stars fled back to Hollywood and no one was making anything. And the people at Muster Dogs said, we can do this show still. We can do it. We can get iPhones into the hands of these graziers. We can get GoPros attached to their trucks. We can make this show. And that was why in the first series you saw Chet getting in his vehicle and having to drive at all the pups all around Australia because they got a special livestock transport permission to get across the borders as the borders were closing everywhere. So it was an incredible act of endurance and persistence, and the people behind it did it all driven by a great respect for the people we were filming and the animals. They knew that they were dealing with people who could be a little vulnerable in front of cameras, and I've seen that all the way through to series two. And we are currently filming, I'm not sure if you're aware, we are filming series three right now. So the new lot of pups are with the participants already out there somewhere. Having to keep it a deep, dark secret from their families even because you're not allowed to tell anyone if you've got one of the Muster Dogs. And so you'd say to your family if they're visiting, oh, you know, we just got a new dog. Like you can't say, actually, it's a Muster Dog and I'm going to be on an international hit TV show. So... just a small secret, which is why we worried so much about Charlie, from Russ's young son, the four-year-old, because he was a bit of a blabbermouth. And so he wanted to tell everyone that they had a Muster Dog. And poor Russ and his wife, Rosie, they were just desperate to try and keep Charlie under control. But then on the finale, when Zoe won, it was her 91-year-old granddad who was kind of excited, but absolutely absolutely terrified that he was going to accidentally tell people, because he said, I cannot remember not to tell people. And then he said, when's this going to air? And I said, oh, look, I'm sorry, you know, Pa, we were calling you. It's not going to air for another 6 months. He said, I've got to keep a secret for 6 months? And then he said...
He's a bloke.
He said, I've got to stay alive for 6 months? Well, he did. It's a happy story. He's still kicking on.
Well, what you get from the book is a lot more detail than Lisa's can possibly give you now about the process, from the idea to going into the lobby meeting, which is a bit depressing. But what you'll pick up from that is these people weren't whimperdites who said, oh, well, that's it, we're rooted. That's that idea gone. They went away and made it work. And that's what produces good books, good TV, good politics, good theatre, good anything. Someone who just doesn't give up. They don't expect the salad on the plate. They go away and make the salad, put it together another way. So they did well. Now, I'll tell you what didn't occur to me from the book, and that is you've got to get all the puppies born together. So you've got to find someone who's yes. going to have puppies when you want them. Puppies yeah. to order. Yeah. And then you've got to divvy them up and send them around. You've got to find the right trainers. It's a bugger of a job, frankly.
And I mean, I was learning so much all the time because I, even though I grew up in the country, we didn't have working dogs. We had one dog called Mac, who was a border collie cross, who spent more time closer to the house than away from it. And see, here's another difference between country and city people, yeah. right? Is your dog a house dog? In the house?
He says no need to go outside unless we're out.
Right, okay. See, country people don't have house dogs. Like, your dogs stay outside, and if the dogs are very good, then they might be able to rest on the veranda. Yeah. But there's a real thing, and I can remember when we sold our house, the family sold the house in Kilkeven, and we'd never had an animal inside, and Mum would keep it so clean, and when the new owners turned up, they turned up and their dog dumped out of the car and ran through the house, and I thought Mum was going to faint. yes.
But when we've gone up in the past to my sister and brother-in-law's place, we've said to our dog, you're not coming. It's the dog Biafra. You don't want to go there. You know, because they're just treated like dogs, for God's sake.
Oh, how can that be?
How terrible. Now, you had a great breadth of personalities in there.
Yeah.
Tremendous one. Let's start with Lily. Lily yeah. Davies Etheridge. Now, she's the lady from Wilcannia, around Madindi. Anyone been to Wilcannia? Yeah, not a tourism spot, really.
But cheap golf. If you want to... See, these are the things I discovered when I was writing the book, because I thought, well, what... I've been to Menindi for the Backroads program, but I hadn't been to Wilcannia, and I thought, what do they do in Wilcannia? Well, it turns out there is a golf course in Wilcannia. It doesn't have any grass, but there is a golf course, and I think it's $2 if you want to play a round of golf. So there you go. Take that with you.
Long way to go for cheap golf, but... In any event, this girl got marks in high school that would have got her into vet science. She didn't go. Now, some people at the university would be appalled at that, because some people think, not only at universities but in the rest of the world, that if you haven't got a university degree, you're not smart. Clearly, that's a stupid thing for people to think. But, you know, she could have and may still go and do, according to the book, vet science. What she does is mustering. And she's good at it. What's her story?
Her story is that from a child, she had an affinity with animals that her whole family saw. And she's delayed that vet science degree, so there is the possibility that she might go and do it. But she just loves being on the land. She was probably, I'd say, the most reluctant of the participants. When I interviewed her, and I think I used the language in the book that she used, that... When I interviewed her, she said, oh, I hope I don't win because... And then she put in a lot of swear words, which I won't say now. But she just was very shy about it and didn't want the attention, but she utterly loves what she does. And so she packs up her dogs, puts them in the ute, and off she goes when someone rings and says, hey, can you come and do a week's worth of mustering? They might have some wild goats. And when goat meat was valuable, they wanted to to round up the wild goats, and so they'd ring someone like Lily and off she'd go for a week. She'd drive 400 kilometres by herself with the dogs and a motorbike, and then she'd round up the goats and go, here you go, thanks for the money, see you next time. And she would just wait for these phone calls to come in. She was 20 years old when I started talking to her. When you saw her on television, she'd turned 21. 21! I couldn't believe it. And I said to her, look, I imagine it's a pretty blokey world out there. Like, how do you deal with that? She's sleeping in the, you know, the quarters where the, you know, everyone is. And she's like, oh, just the only thing that pisses me off is when people say I can't do something because I'm a girl. And that was her kind of approach to life. And I just, they are so strong, the women, whether it's Scylla, whether it's Zoe, whether it's Lily, they all just brought an incredible attitude that made me think, wow, if I needed anything done, they are the women to get stuff done.
Indeed. It was a very impressive read. I mean, 21. Mm. God help me, doing a great job. I'd like to meet that girl. Now, you mentioned Steve Elliott from Winton.
Yes.
Is another Steve. Example, if I'd mentioned before that Lily's out there doing things, you know, she makes her own decisions. No, I'm not going to university, that's not going to suit me now. I'm going to do this, and she's doing it. That's at 21, it's a tremendous example. I don't want to disparage any of your friends and relatives, but just think if you know any other 21-year-olds that would be prepared to work on their own in a small business as them as a sole proprietor mustering out of Wilcannia. Mm. That girl's got some gumption. Now, let's go to Steve Elliott. There's another example of someone who doesn't whinge and say, oh, life's given me a bad set of cards. Mm. Oh, dear, I'm a victim. Mm. No, he's out there doing it.
Yeah.
That's another great story.
Even though he's been in a wheelchair for 20 years when he was came off a bucking bronc at the Townsville Black River Rodeo.
And I have to interrupt there. That yes. does mean that Steve's got a little bit of element of idiot in him.
Well,
because why would you do that?
Oh, I think that too, but so many people do. It is a real sport and they love it. You know what? Steve's funny, and I really hope that you got a sense, if you've seen the second series, that kind of humour that comes through with Steve. It took a long time for me to gain his trust, and I tried to, when I was writing the book, when the Muster Dogs people asked me to write the book, I rang him to say, look, could we have a bit of a chat because I'd like to ask you some more questions about things. And he gave me nothing. And then I thought, right, I'm going to have to get on a plane and go up to Winton and see Steve myself. And so I said, Steve, how would you feel if I came up? And he went, okay, whatever you want to do, Lisa. And I said, okay, well, I'm coming up, Steve. So I got up to Winton. And I made a really bad mistake of opening the questions, wanting to ask him about the accident. And he just shut down. And then he didn't talk to me again. And when I then got back to Melbourne, having had an unsuccessful sort of 36-hour round trip to try and get something out of Steve for the book, he texted me and he said, g'day, Lisa, it's Steve. This is in the text, so I'm just adding his voice to it. What were those questions you wanted to ask me? And I thought, oh, Steve, curse you. But that was okay because it then opened the relationship with us so much. In fact, he took so many questions that I was utterly touched when he said that one of his dogs had had puppies and he thought he might name one Lisa. And I said, that is so lovely, Steve. And he said, yeah, because she's nosy and a big sticky beak. And you know, when I did the audiobook for Muster Dogs, I had the best fun because I had to do all the voices when I was doing the audiobook. But then, of course, as I get to chapter 5 or 6, I think, oh, what was the voice I had for Lily? Is this the same voice that I gave Steve in chapter 2? So I had to keep trying to remember what voices I'd given them. If anyone has listened to the audiobook, please let me know if I have failed to deliver on that.
Didn't you say he's got some sort of Segway thing? Not just a normal wheelchair?
No, he's got six different wheelchairs and they're all pretty dusty, but one of them is built like a Segway and so it moves with the balance of him moving. And I watched him using that Segway round the pool table at the North Gregory pub that night when we had dinner, and I thought, wow, you are so talented. And then the next day, again, no complaints. I mean, Winton is so hot. If you're feeling a little warm here, imagine another 10, 15 degrees and not being able to regulate your own body temperature because of the accident. And so he had a fire hydrant filled with water, and whenever he got too hot during the day, he'd just get it out and wet himself down to try and cool off, because it was always a very fine balance. And I said to Steve, hey, so what happens when you don't get it right? Like, what happens if you get too hot? And he looked at me and he just dropped his head like that. And he said, that's what happens.
Yeah, country people can be very cryptic, if you like. Yes. I know of a suicide that was in the northern Queensland, I think it was, or southern Queensland, sorry. Anyway, the coppers go out to speak to the station manager and say, what do you reckon happened? The station manager, I suppose he got a bit sick of things. Mm. You know, they don't say much, do they?
They don't.
No.
But for me, it was such an education, and I have had a lot of joy of bringing these stories to life, you know, that we weren't able to tell in the 5 hours that you watched on television.
Yep. Now, we do have, actually, a Kelpie here today.
Oh,
how are you going, Bont?
Where's Bont?
Would Bont like to sit at the front? You're welcome to stay where you are, but if Bont would like to come up the front, he'd be welcome.
The first time I did one of these chats, it was in Canberra, and people brought their dogs to the ANU so they could have photos with me and the book. And I thought, how fabulous. And I thought, oh, I wonder if anyone's going to bring their dog in Adelaide. And yes, beautiful Bont, a beautiful Kelpie is sitting over there. So that's gorgeous. Oh,
we can't hear, but you could charge $5 for a photo with him.
Yeah.
You'd be right.
Oh, Bont.
Bont. Come on, Bont.
Bont.
Bonty.
Bont.
Come on, Bont.
Come on, Bont.
Bont.
Over here, Bont.
Here we are.
Bont.
Bont.
Oh, Bont's confused
by the speakers.
Bont.
Here, Bont. Come on.
Hello, Bont.
No, microphones are confusing. Oh. Come on, darling.
Hello, Bont.
Come on. No. Sound coming from everywhere for Montepelli.
Poor Bont.
Beautiful dog. Oh. Now, let's get on to the dogs. I mean, people are important. I get that. But
yes.
So are the dogs.
Let's talk about the dogs.
Kelpies versus Collies. Which are you?
Can you remember?
I want to know. Let's start with the big question. Kelpie versus Collie.
I can't answer that.
Why not?
Because it's like Holden versus Ford. Everyone's going to have an opinion, and as they say, it is not the breed, it is how they are bred, and it's the different model of the breeding. And one of the things that we did with when you talk about, a dog pregnancy, how do you make sure you've got the litters to be the right numbers for the number of participants, because you could match two dogs together and they're the perfect dogs to breed, and then you end up with three puppies and the camera crews, they're looking at it all. And even with Debbie in the second series, do you see how I'm avoiding answering the question? I do this really
You're
well.
Trying.
the puppy, the Debbie who was the mum in the second series, they did an ultrasound of Debbie, but there were so many pups in there that they actually couldn't see where one overlapped another. So they weren't sure whether they had enough or not. And they thought, we think there are seven. And so you wanted five for the participants, but then you wanted kind of a couple of surprises, you know, one that ended up with Frank, the deaf dog, which was a shock to all of us. Beautiful little Lucky. And so when Debbie gave birth to 10 pups, then that was, we knew, right, we're okay. We've got enough pups for the show. They are all beautifully well-bred, happy little pups. And Lucky was another little storyline we weren't anticipating.
I've had neither, but I suspect if I had to choose, and when Ern, who's, as I said, 35-kilo Weimaraner, goes to the big kennel in the sky, Tony will probably be, I don't know, 77, 78. that's not the age to buy a 35-kilo dog. So we'll probably look at something smaller.
Shih Tzu?
No. I know there was one up on a property. What was it called? Teeny or Weenie or something?
Minty.
Minty.
Yeah.
It did seem... Well, you tell a story about Minty, this little Shih Tzu on a property.
Yeah. I mean, I was... It when I arrived at the property, this is Scylla in Ban Ban Springs in southeast Queensland. This little Shih Tzu comes running out... Ruff, 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 like it's some big guard dog, right? I mean, I could have stepped on it if I wasn't looking properly. And it turned out that Minty the Shih Tzu would try to be a working dog and would leap off the ute and go chasing the cows. And no matter how much Scylla tried to stop Minty going out there, she wanted to do it. And Scylla was worried, A, that she might get trampled by the cows or simply have an eagle come along and pick it up and take it because it was so tiny. But a lot of farmers these days have sausage dogs as well. Yeah, that seems to be the kind of go-to dog for the property. So you could try a sausage dog.
No.
Okay. All right.
Maybe a beagle, I don't know. But anyway, let's not worry about...
I think, look, if you really forced me to say which dog I prefer, I'd probably say Border Collie. I think they're... I know, see, here
I might say Philby.
Here is the controversy of the Writers' Festival, and we thought it was going to be somewhere else, but it's the Kelpies versus Border Collies question. That's the one. Yeah.
But Kelpies have just got... I mean, I know Collies have as well. Such a smart face. I mean, because they're smart, you can see that they're watching, thinking, you know, they know what's going on. They had a story about one of the guys whose wife was very unwell. She got a battle of leukemia. Yeah. Got through it and was filming.
That's Russ and Rosie.
His dogs, you tell the story.
Yeah, well, they got him through. They would give him the comfort that was like having friends that would keep him supported when he came back from the hospital each day. And you know, Rosie's illness is a kind of story that I wanted to add to with this book because... It was like she had a 10-month-old child. She thought she was tired from being a young mum, but there was a bruise on her leg that just wouldn't go away. And the doctor rang them at 10 o'clock that night after the blood test came in and said, "You've got to go to hospital tomorrow. You've got like leukemia. You've got blood cancer. This is serious." And so suddenly Russ has a 10-month-old baby that is immediately having to be weaned from his mum. And he's got a property he's running and he's got a wife who's in hospital with a serious illness. So that to know that the dogs for him became part of that support network, that he would come home and those dogs would give him that kind of comfort, was just beautiful to watch. And that's what came through. And I think why Zoe ended up the winner, because so many of them were very talented, but Zoe and Buddy had this incredible relationship, especially after Buddy almost lost his life. I mean, Buddy was so sick. I was at home in Melbourne when the producer rang me and she was in Catherine with Zoe at the vet and she rang me and she said, "I think we're going to lose Buddy." And I went, "No way," because this has been our great fear while we've been making the series that we would lose one of the dogs. Farm work is dangerous. Dogs die and dogs get sick. They get bitten by snakes. And as much as we could do to care for them, that was such a great fear. So Buddy was way sicker than we kind of let on in the TV show because we didn't want to dwell on that and make people too upset. But it was touch and go. And at the same time, Zoe is having to deal with the breakdown of her relationship. So we started filming and Zoe's has a partner and we're filming all of that. And then as the months go on, life happens, you know? Life happens. And so Zoe and her boyfriend break up and it's really tough for her. And she's suddenly realising she signed up to do a TV show and... this is kind of on camera. But this is why, again, I just want to talk about the respect that the producers have for the people who are part of it, because we didn't dwell on that in the show. We didn't dwell on the breakdown of the relationship. I think I said one line that Zoe was now single. And the other thing that I have done these days that I didn't do in the past as a younger journalist is I send chapters off. Oh, no, I'm getting there, though. I send chapters off to allow people to read them because I think they are trusting me to tell their story. I don't want to get it wrong, and I don't want them to see something months down the track that might make them balk or not be happy to give their granddad a copy of the book and say, hey, here's, I'm in this book. And I think we've been reluctant as journalists in the past to ever do that. We certainly grew up being taught that wasn't what you did. And I did it with my first book, Daring to Fly. It was my family and I got them to look at it all, and it was only when we got right to the point where the book was being printed that I realised one of my brothers had read none of the manuscripts that I had sent through, and I'd written something that he was desperate not to have included in the book. So that was slightly tricky, but we got through that. We're still happy siblings, but yeah, The different stories there. I just wanted to add that, Amanda, because sometimes people...
Well, they are rich stories.
Yeah, and I just think it's respectful to hand it over to people and say, have a look. Are you happy? Yeah.
Gee, I wish the ABC did with that with me with interviews. Anyway, that's another point. Now, the dogs, they have a really important industrial role.
Yeah.
You know, why don't you tell us a bit about how many stockmen a dog can replace? And that's not because property owners, pastoralists, whether in the for sheep or cattle, want to get rid of stockmen. They can't get them. They can't get them. So what can a dog do?
Three. The work of three people. And that's why they're so valuable. The most expensive Kelpie sold for $49,000 in October 2022. Its name is Capri Eve. Still doing well, still working the property. They work on the basis that if they buy a dog that is going to work for a decade, if you pay $49,000 for it, I mean, that was a high price and definitely shocked the industry at the time, but you are going to get your money's worth out of it. Or as Joni in the first series said with a really dry response, as she always did, remember Joni who was in WA with 20 dogs and... She said it got a bit lonely out there and then suddenly she's getting kind of messages on matching internet thingies from people going, we'll help you with your loneliness. She's like, no, I do not need help with my loneliness. But Joni very wryly said that dogs can't go to the HR department. So, but I mean, you know, the reality is she treats her dogs so well. They are her friends and that they are so valuable because we can't get people into regional Australia. And when anyone in the city might ask, well, why does this, what's this to do with me? It's like, well, we should all care about what's happening on the land. We all eat, we all clothe ourselves. No matter what you might eat or how you eat it, we all need to be involved in these conversations. And I think that was an important part of the book as well.
Yeah, I think so. Plenty of city people perhaps don't turn their mind to where their food comes from and the effort that goes into the production of it. You look at the price of lamb chops in the butcher and think, oh, my God, if you heard what the pastoralists get for the lamb, you'd be equally surprised at how much is added on after it leaves the pastoral property. But these people work very hard. They do a great job and many are just focused on producing a particular type of meat, you know, more fatty meat for that supermarket, less fatty meat for this one, bigger legs of lamb for that one, etc. It's not just let the sheep go, let them eat grass and sell them at the end of the year. That's a very sort of ignorant, perhaps, city view that some might have. It's a very specialised business, the meat production industry.
And it's one that Frank Finger talks about. I mean, man, how much do we love Frank Finger?
A lot.
He is as kind and beautiful as he came across in the series. He looks after everyone. When I was writing the book, I was kind of ringing around all of them to say, can you remember where you were when the first episode went to air? Like, what were you doing? How did you watch it? And Frank said to me that they were so excited about it going to air that they bought a new television. And, you know, if you're a farmer in central Queensland and you know there are going to be some bad years ahead, you want to put a bit of money away, you don't go and buy new televisions willy-nilly. And so he had the whole family over. I said, "What did you eat, Frank?" And he said, "I smoked a brisket and I had a glass of red wine." And I could picture Frank doing that. It was just such a beautiful thing. You know, I often text the ones from the second series to ask them how everything's going. And Steve said to me that he reckons Indy is missing the cameras, that Indy sort of goes out and she's like, oh, I'm not the centre of attention anymore. Indy's just one of the dogs, right? Just one of the dogs. And to give you an idea of Lily as well, it's probably been a couple of weeks since I've been in touch with Lily, but when I spoke to her, and remember, this show went to air on January the 14th and could be binged immediately or watched slowly over the next 5 weeks, Lily hadn't got around to watching it yet and didn't seem bothered by that. I was like, wow, she is so tough. She's tough.
Well, the differences are there, aren't they? Frank seemed, from the book, a fabulous character. Mm. And as you've already said, Lisa, he's the one that was given the blind dog named Lucky, as we name people with red hair Bluey. Some of the blind dog gets called Lucky. But Lucky was lucky because Lucky met up with Flo, another dog. And what's that story? I've just about got glassy eyes reading.
It's so
a beautiful story.
This, because we, of course, weren't anticipating there was going to be a deaf dog, and we didn't know for a little while. You saw on the TV series how it was all the other pups would go running and Lucky would still be asleep and they'd clap the hand above Lucky and there was no response, so they knew that Lucky was deaf. So Frank took on Lucky, as he took on Lucifer, who he renamed Lucy and who's now a fantastic dog who heads off to aged care homes and comforts people in their later years. Frank has a magic touch. So what happened with Lucky is that when Frank first got Lucky, the Lucky was with the dogs, and every night as it got dark, Lucky would start barking, barking, barking. And Frank thought, oh, what am I going to do with this? So he turned a light on, and as soon as the light came on, Lucky stopped barking. And so he did it the next night, turned the light on, Lucky stopped barking. And Frank thought, okay, Lucky can't hear, so relies on sight. And as soon as it gets dark, Lucky's panicking. So Frank, this is how beautiful Frank is. He said, so I got an extension cord of about 300 metres and I ran it from my bedroom out the window down to the dogs so I could just flick the light on when I was going to bed and then flick it off later. And within a week, Lucky stopped barking in the dark. So just that knowledge, it was okay, people were there. And so then Flo, another little pup, came along and Lucky and Flo got friendly. And so Flo then took it on herself to show Lucky what was needed and what was being done. Frank would use vibrations on the ground to try and let Lucky know that action needed to be required, and then Lucky would look at Flo and go, what do I have to do here, Flo? And Flo would say, come on, Lucky, off we go. And they'd round up the cattle and it was just absolutely beautiful to see. So Lucky is living Lucky's best life there in Clermont in central Queensland.
I think everyone's lucky to have Lucky, probably.
Oh, everyone's lucky to have a Frank in their lives, actually. It was Frank's 70th birthday the other week, and he and his wife, Kathy, tell this great story about the first series when he'd bought the new TV set. They didn't binge it. They just watched the one episode that night. But all his mates were ringing him and saying, oh, we know you won. We binged it. And then this car comes up the driveway and this couple, it's a strange car, this couple get out. And they go, oh, Frank Finger, we're, you know, Amanda and Lisa, whatever, we've come from down the road. We've got a problem with our Kelpie. We're wondering if you could help us. And Frank's like, seriously? Oh, okay. And then they said, actually, we're wondering if we could breed it with one of your dogs. And then Frank said to me, I could have brought out a fox terrier and I reckon they would have been happy for any breeding to go on.
I think there's a business for Frank in Well, maybe for a different series, and that's training your dog.
Well,
Frank could be the star of that.
There's a whole chapter in the book about Frank's tips, whether you live in the city and you've got a city dog or if you've got a country dog. How do you stop a dog peeing too much or sniffing too much, or how do you stop them jumping up on people and all the rest of it? And boy, that was a fun conversation. I settled in with Frank on the phone for about 3.5 hours when we worked on that chapter. Frank loves a chat. I love Frank. He loves a chat.
Right. Now, what one of the things, this is about you, surprised me in the book is, do you believe this? They made her audition to be the presenter, the audio. How dumb you got to be. But they were quite fussy because you were a bit apprehensive about this.
Oh, it was super apprehensive. I was brought in at the very last moment in series one because of all those COVID difficulties. Even though the show had got made, it was right up against deadline. It actually went over deadline. And they were going to have a generic voice tell the story. And then they thought, no, we think we probably need a name. And they had a few people in mind. I don't know who those people are, but thankfully for me, they didn't get the gig. But they rang on a Friday afternoon. And, you know, when you get up at 3 o'clock every morning to present a news breakfast program, Friday afternoon is not the time to be having a conversation with one of those presenters. Like, you are a zombie. It's like you've got jet lag by the end of the week. And they rang me and they said, oh, we've got this series about dogs and we're wondering if you might be interested. And I was like, oh, yeah, cool, that'd be cool. And they said, okay, well, we'll send you through a script. Can you record yourself on your iPhone reading the script because we need to audition? We'll send it out to the outside producers. We'll see if they like your voice. And I thought, oh, okay. So I did that and we a couple of times and they asked for a few changes and eventually they gave me the gig. But that wasn't the worst of it. What happened then was on the very first day that I'm recording the voiceover and time is of the essence, because we've already gone over deadline with the show. I am in the radio studio in Melbourne. The audio technician is there. The producer is locked down in Brisbane because she couldn't get back across the border. There's another producer on Zoom in Sydney. And they're giving me instructions like I've gone through NIDA. They are saying things like, on the third word in that second sentence, just have an upward inflection and put a little smile in your voice with a bit of a giggle at the end. And I'm like, I can't do this. I was so stressed that I was then going to let everyone down that I went home and I rang my best friend, Lee Sales, and I said, I don't think I can do this. And she said what every good supportive friend says, oh, why don't you drop out? And I say to her now, thank God I did not take your advice, because Muster Dogs has just been the most joyful thing that has come into my life of late, apart from a few other things, and sitting in the front row. And it's just been so wonderful. So I'm so glad that I did not, that I ignored Lee Sales.
Are you sure she meant it, or did she know you so well that she was calling your bluff?
No, she meant it, because her biggest worry for me has been that I take on too many projects, and I was already getting up at 3 o'clock every morning and doing back roads, and she'd watched me already go through the process of writing Daring to Fly, and she just thought this is just one more project that my mate Lisa could probably live without. So I'm glad I ignored her. But she ignored me, because when she wanted to quit 7:30, I said, don't. And she did. So now we're even.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Now, one of the comments made somewhere in the book, and it might have been by Mr. Finger, I don't know, was that what the dog needs is a skill, instinct and fearlessness. And when I read that, I thought, that's true of a lot of jobs, for people as well. I mean, your job, you have to have skill. You certainly have to have instinct. And you can't be a whimper dog. You wouldn't have got where you are if you were wimpy.
No. I think I have forced myself through many moments of fear, including, and Amanda very kindly has read my first book, my memoir, Daring to Fly, where I talk about the fact that I had, thank you, Amanda, that I had a terrible fear of flying that was going to prevent me following my dream of becoming a foreign correspondent, which was the dream of a little country kid. But I forced myself onto planes to go and do jobs and assignments, especially after September 11 in America, where, I mean, I would be physically ill at the thought of getting on the plane, but I knew I had to do it. Mm. So I think all of us actually might have that sort of, on the outside it looks like fearlessness, but we all have something going on inside that is very different to that.
Yeah, well, a lack of apprehension, a complete lack of apprehension, is a complete idiot.
Mm. True.
But you shouldn't let apprehension turn into fear.
No.
So there's a difference. I understand that. What about other jobs? Do you think the people you know in every other job require that or
require the instinct and skill and fearlessness?
Well, skill and instinct and fearlessness. I mean, look, I worked in retailing when I left school.
I was just thinking of retailing then. I don't know why that jumped into my mind as well.
It does require skill. It does require skill. First of all, you've got to know what stuff's there, for starters. You have to learn how to peel off the partner. For example, when people come in together.
Oh.
You're buying a dress, I say to your friend, that's a lovely dress that she's got on because she thinks that lady's smart. She recognises I've got nice clothes and all of a sudden that lady is my partner, not yours.
You would have been an excellent seller.
I didn't
clothes.
Do a lot of selling, but I did learn that. Be nice to the lady who's hanging around because she's going to make or break the sale.
Oh,
you need some instinct for that and you need a bit of fearlessness. I mean, you know, choosing a gown for someone and they say, can we bring back a credit? Yes. Who will I, you know, make it out to? It's something funeral home. You know, like it's a dress to dress a body and they want to think if they can bring it back.
Did that actually happen
yes,
to you?
Yes, and when you're quite young, it takes a bit of to say, can you just wait on a minute while I get some advice?
Oh, no.
You want to say, don't kid yourself, mate, you're not bringing that back here. Anyway, look.
But those dogs do, I mean, the fearlessness that those dogs show when they just head out to
split
round
second decision,
up.
They go.
Yeah, they go. They go. And they show it from such an early age. And it was just incredible learning so much about the different breeds.
Okay. Now, I'm a Kelpie, she's a Collie. Oh, sorry, one more question. The book does describe the difference between Kelpies and Collies in terms of what your car's like.
Mm.
Which is which? One is the messy car with the lemonade tins and crap everywhere and the other's very neat. I think the Collie's neat.
I can't remember.
I think the Collie's neat. Are you neat?
I'm very neat.
Right, yeah. I'm not and I'm the Kelpie, so I'm pretty sure that's right. They mirror our personality as well. Now, have any of you got a question you'd like to ask? If you have, you need to come to the microphone over here. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes so we can do a few and someone's coming. You can ask Lisa anything.
The people on the show were so generous and they put in so much work. And I think they got the dogs, which was a valuable thing for them. Was that all they got? Can you give us the behind the scenes? Did they get anything else?
Yeah. No, they got the dog. So, and the dogs, because of the quality of the breeding, are sought after, highly sought after. And also, Joe Spicer and Mick Hudson and Carolyn, they're not breeding willy-nilly. Like, there's not this sense of, let's just get as many puppies as we can out there. They do not do it that way. Those dogs have generations of breeding that have been, that have gone into it. It's like Mick Hudson, who if you go to any sheep trials around Australia, you'll see him in action because he's currently the Australian champion. He's held that title for years. He took it from his father. His father took it from his grandfather. You get the idea that this is a very talented family and that's how they treat the breeding. So what did everyone get? They got a chance to show a part of their world that they wanted people to understand and believe in, and that was what drove them. They are so authentic and passionate about what they did, and they felt that there had been misunderstandings over the years, and they wanted people to see how they were reducing the use of machines on their properties, reducing the use of helicopters, increasing the use of dogs, and doing it with respect and kindness. Yeah. And they got the dog.
Yeah. Without mentioning figures, do they get a cut of the on sales or the merch?
No. I think that was a question
the lady wanted to ask. There's a gentleman at the microphone.
Hi, Lisa. I was just wondering if you could maybe speak to the producers and put forward an idea of having guide dogs and therapy dogs as a future series and seasons.
Yeah, it's that idea has come up previously. I think commercial TV might have done something with guide dogs, but the fact when we talk about working dogs, you are spot on suggesting that, of course, rightly, working dogs are guide dogs, and working dogs are the dogs that go out with the fire brigade and ambulance and, yeah, so it's definitely being discussed, and thank you very much for raising it here.
Yeah. Don't forget those customs dogs.
Customs dogs. There's so many working dogs out there.
They don't divide them into Kelpie and Collie. They divide them into passenger dogs and freight dogs. Freight dogs are the excitable ones that scratch at the bulks, and the passenger dogs sit quietly by you and say, you've got something where the sun doesn't shine.
Oh.
The lady in blue.
Hello. Thank you very much for Master Dogs. I've got a very quick question, similar theme to the previous question. Are you going to make my day and tell me that you're going to do a series on Australian cattle dogs?
I can't tell you what the next series is on. I've been asked that question so many times. All I am allowed to say is that there's a twist, and that is it. I'm so sorry I can't tell more
details. I hope it's healers too.
Yeah, cattle dogs, I know people have raised that as well.
Sheila the healer the star.
But thank you. I will I will pass it on again.
Doesn't sound like you need to, but anyway. The gentleman at the microphone.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for the show. We have a border collie, and she's usually indifferent to what's on TV, but she watches Mustard Dogs. Some friends of ours have said their dogs also watch Mustard Dogs. Is that something that people have told you about?
Oh, my goodness. From the first moment that... Thank you for the question. That episode one went to air, my social media blew up with videos of people's dogs either... So these were the things that were happening. A dog would chase one of the Mustard Dogs across the screen and then get to the end of the television and wonder where they'd gone. And so then they're running around the back of the TV trying to work out where that damn dog's gone. And then people, and I've got stories in the book as well about people who contacted the show, because there were some really beautiful stories from people about their own dog stories. One of them was a cat story, can you believe it? So this couple moved to the country, they took their cat, there was a dog there, the cat hated the dog, would go nowhere near the dog, but because the cat sat and watched Mustard Dogs all the time, it eventually grew to love the dog. And so they messaged me with a photo of this cat and dog curled up together and said, this is because of your show.
I have a friend whose cat, Maggie, watches it and loves it. The gentleman at the microphone.
So... Yeah, for sure. Hi, Lisa. Congratulations on your book. I've read it. It's magnificent for a person who's going to Casterton for 11 years now. So it's such a joy to see you there 2 years ago with the ABC crew. When you were talking about secrets, I just finished doing the parade and you were just interviewing Frank Finger at the time. I walked past you with my dogs. And at the end of the parade, I met Rob Trunk with his wife. And I said, what's going to happen with the new series? And I said, I propose that we should have Kelpies at Warwick Homestead, which is the birthplace of the Kelpie, and do trials there for Mustard Dogs. And he said, no, they're actually doing a Border Collie series. So do people break secrets in Mustard Dogs?
I love that. Clearly they do. Clearly they break secrets. But that's pretty funny that Rob told you that sometime beforehand. Wow, OK, we need to work on those contracts we're getting them to sign.
Yeah. Those dogs apparently came to Australia after 1900. I would have thought it would be a lot earlier, but it's quite late, surprisingly.
And if you've ever, if you ever get the chance to go to the Casterton Kelpie Muster, it is amazing. Like, thousands and thousands of people and just as many dogs, and it is so much fun over a long weekend in Casterton. Thank you.
You'll go there next year, Bonty. The gentleman in the striped T-shirt.
Oh, yes. Having grown up as a... first years of my life as a shepherd boy back in on the small Greek island, we never had those dogs. That's what took so interest in that show, because I really like to take dogs like that back to the shepherds there. Look, you know, these are dogs. They do the work for you. And they just, you know, and it's been my lifelong obsession to sort of, my thoughts. That's why I stayed for this talk. because I say, here you go. There's a dog that I can go in there around your sheep rather than going, you know, because that dogs don't do nothing like that. So.
Oh, well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. The show has been not series two yet, but series one became a huge hit on Netflix in the UK and the US. And series two will be shown over there as well if you have friends or family. I started getting messages from English sheepdog societies that wanted to start telling me why we should be doing or setting up some kind of competition with the English sheepdog. And I thought, well, if that's...
No, we'll beat them.
No, we'll beat them. Yeah, it's bad enough in the cricket, isn't it? Like, we just... thank you, the lady in the red and white checks.
I don't think there's enough time, but anyway, Lisa, thank you very, very much for Muster Dogs. My husband and I binged it. We loved it. And we've got a Kelpie as well. But why I'm asking this is, and I don't think there is enough time, is that I just wanted you to expand on the role of the McDonald's.
Oh, Neil and Helen, the trainers who are involved with Series 2 as well. I can just very briefly, because I had the privilege of spending time on their property in Keith in South Australia, and they have so many people that they come and train who go there now. And honestly, they are such fantastic people, so welcoming. Helen runs that property while Neil spends his time now all over Australia roaming the place. They are great. You will continue to see them. Thank you so much for the question.
Right, could we have a round of applause for Lisa? This isn't a one-off for her. I'm sure publishers are real pains in the butt and get her to do quite a bit of it. And I don't know about you, but I haven't felt for one minute that there was any lack of freshness or spontaneity and honesty with us about the opportunity to participate in such a fabulous series. Say, if there's any contract lawyers here, get onto those trainers, you know, the people who get the dogs, make sure they get a cut next time.
I'm going to be signing books over underneath the black umbrellas. I'd love to see you there. Thank you.
It's a great gift. Buy it as a gift.